turbulent and cold. Risk a career selling this junk. Happy to $9.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Sinclair Lewis's 1927 novel Elmer Gantry is considered one of the masterpieces of early 20th century American literature. It tells the story of an old-time preacher who tries to cover his predilection towards worldly interests like money and girls over saving souls.
80 years after the book was published, it was adapted as an opera. The Florentine Opera won a 2011 Grammy Award for its recording of it. The company presents a new production of Elmer Gantry this weekend, and ahead of that, we're joined in the studio by mezzo-soprano Catherine Procht, bass Kevin Burdett, and conductor Christopher Larkin, who says he has an unusual in to the work.
Robert Aldrich, the composer, and I happen to live in the same town. So it's been great to be able to have him come over to the house and sit down and talk about the piece. And we can go through things. I can ask, you know, is this what you meant here? You know, it's a slight difference in rhythm here from the first time this happened. Did you mean for this to be an eighth and for this to be a quarter? And we talk about, you know, tempos and maybe moving here a little bit or pulling back there. So it's such a I always think how great it would be to be able to email Mozart or iChat with Mozart and say, what were you thinking here? And what, you know. So there is, you know, the reason this is coming back. And I do want to thank Bill Florescu for asking me to be a part of this, because it's almost a victory lap for this piece, because, as you know, it won 2 Grammys. And Bill had the desire to bring it back, but also to put a fresh stamp on it with a completely new cast and a new conductor. Only to just get a fresh take on it, a fresh outlook on it. The only holdover is Frank Kelly, who sang the role of Eddie in the original production, but is now making his stage directing debut with this piece. And it's just been such a treat to have Frank in the room and to have that wealth of experience that he brings to the piece, because he was in on the original workshops in Boston that started in 1992. So he's lived with this piece for a long time and has done that incredibly difficult aria of Eddie's, but also, you know, has a sense of how the piece has developed and grown over the years and was part of that original production. So it's great to have him next to me all the time.
That institutional knowledge has to be just wonderful.
Oh, it's
to
fantastic.
Be able to draw
it's
on.
Fantastic. Yeah.
And so, Katie and Kevin, you are new to this piece.
Yes.
And so you're in this kind of rethinking of it. What is it like for you to come in on something that is an award-winning opera, but we're in a kind of a new way of thinking about it?
I mean, I do a lot of new work, and I really love the fact that this one has been done before, so there is a recording to listen to. And, you know, I like the idea, too, that there's a book. I was able to read the book. I was able to watch the movie and hear the recording. And because of Skype, I was able to talk to Herschel Garfein, the librettist, and kind of get an idea of what the character was supposed to be. But the thing I like most about doing new opera, new work, is that I don't have 200 years of past recording and experience to have to be compared to. I get to create my own character. And I generally try to play myself as the character anyway, try to sing with my voice and not try to recreate what I've heard before. So while it's great to have a reference with the recording, it's also lovely to put it away and just rely on, you know, on my musical skills and, you know, and coaching and creating the role the way I would do it myself.
Right. It's you have only one recording to put away.
Correct. As opposed to 30.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And Kevin, for you?
Oh, for me, it's just a joy to be able to be a part of this production. I've known Herschel for years and sort of out of that decided to go see the world premiere production. It was, I think it started in Nashville. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And then it went to Montclair State just out of New York City. And so I was able to go and see the production and I was overwhelmed by it. I was so moved. I felt like there's something about it that really resonated very deeply with me, and I was weeping, no joke, just so absorbed in the music and in the production that I spent the whole night weeping, and later told Herschel, man, it would be such a pleasure, such an honor to be able to perform that opera, and it's got legs. I'm sure it'll be done again because it's such a fantastic opera. So when Mr. Florescu called, I jumped at the opportunity,
But you can't cry during this. You have to actually sing.
Oh, just watch me. What you don't get is I'm singing T.J. Rigg. I have very little to sing, so I can cry the whole show, basically.
Okay.
You won't even know the difference.
Just no. Turn up stage and, yeah.
But it's – so it's a total joy. And to come in with a new piece, new to us and relatively new to the world, it's nice to be able to trust the composition team. You know, I've seen it, so I know it's genius. And also be able to trust the production team. When you see that Maestro Larkins is working – on the show, you know you're going to come in and know someone who has really dug deep into the music, into the text, and will be able to sort of like an onion just peel back what Bob was looking for. And so it's to sort of come in and to know the music and have your own ideas, but also trust that Frank, who knows it as well as anyone, and the maestro are going to be able to guide you. It's sort of it's a real pleasure. And it's a really safe feeling, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it sounds like it's safe in the way that it allows you to really explore.
That's
and,
right.
And go out. You have that wonderful foundation.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Yeah. I feel like rehearsals are like a big sandbox, and I get to play and play, and they'll tell me. Maestro will tell me and Frank will tell me if the sand's going out of the sandbox. But as you sort of get to discover it and still know it's part of the – it's in the right sort of milieu. It's in the right sort of – it's the right tone because you can trust them.
Do you think that Elmer Gantry, this particular opera, is sort of – where American opera is going? Because this is such a particularly American score, American story. We have the living librettist and the composer. And it seems like that this is so peculiarly American.
It is. But I think that's part of the subject matter. You know, it's very gospel-influenced, this score. There's gospel going throughout the whole opera and these incredible big, big gospel scenes, big numbers that just crescendo to the end of the scene. So I think that's part of it. I don't think – you know, we have Dead Man Walking, pieces like that which are drawn from American film or American literature. So it could be, but not necessarily purely Americana. But I think this piece, you know, there are so many American themes going through it. Football. Elmer's a football player. Frank throws a little baseball reference in there. We hear the locomotion and electricity, all these things sort of becoming developed. So it is a real American piece. What yeah. I would like to say is this cast is just fantastic, just a fantastic group of people. Not only is Frank great at the helm, and not only the artist next to me, but Craig Verm, who's singing Elmer, and the rest of the cast down the line are just so committed to the piece. It's a real treat. And in some ways, it's nice that everyone is new to the piece. You don't have people from the old production, and not that there's anything wrong with that, but just so there's not a person, well, we did this last time. It almost helps sort of level the playing field for everyone involved.
And it's like what Katie was saying about having only that one recording.
That's
in this
right.
case, you know, you've got kind of a fresh eyes from everybody.
Yeah, that's why I love doing new pieces as well. It's more of a creative process, I think. You don't have that tradition. You know, when I do a piece like Bohème, which I've now done many, many times, but there are so many recordings. You have to listen to them all, you know, really, you do, just to see what's out there and then come up with your own take on what you would like to do the piece. Here, I love being, especially on premieres, because it gives you a chance to not only talk with the composer, but to create rather than recreate. You know, you really are creating for the first time something and hopefully putting a very personal stamp on it. And I find it much more, the process much more creative than trying to recreate.
The one thing that I think of, though, with all of this is that audiences tend to go to the things that they know. You know, it's very difficult. One of the truisms of radio is that you go where the audience is. You don't try to bring them to you. And I think that might be true for, you know, opera and theater and classical music as well. You've got an audience that thinks they know what they like. You know, they want their Mozarts and they want their Brahms and they want Bohème and they want, you know, whatever. But how do you meet them with a piece, a new piece like this, you know, or any new piece, particularly opera, which already has a reputation that's not deserved but is out there as being sort of elitist and not really for everybody?
Right.
Yeah. How do you bring them in?
Well, this wasn't always the way it was. You know, in Rossini's day, it was always – people were anxious to hear the next new thing. You know, he would write so many operas in one year, and he would even be criticized if he stole something from a previous opera. Oh, that sounds just like Barbara Seville. And I think what will keep this art form alive is to keep creating and doing new things. And people – You know, not that we want to get rid of all that fantastic, you know, there's nothing more beautiful than Marriage of Figaro. I think it's one of the most perfect pieces ever written. You would never want to not do that in a season or any of the great Bohème. I love the third act of Bohème is just a masterpiece, you know. But at the same time, we need to keep the art form alive and growing and nurture the old stuff and also produce new things. And as Bill Ferrescue is doing, bringing it back for a second time. So people say, maybe I should have seen it the first time. Or even those people who saw it once will now see it again. So they feel like they're coming in with the background that they might say, well, I saw Bohème. I think I'll see it again because I enjoyed it the first time. You know, it's a financial risk with companies to produce new pieces because they don't know if they're going to get the audience. And it's up to, you know, general directors and producers to take that risk sometimes.
And for singers, too.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I think that you make a wonderful point. And it sort of ties back into an earlier question when you said, is this sort of the way American opera is going? And I wonder if this opera, if Elmer Gantry, wasn't sort of on the vanguard of this a new wave that I sense in American opera, at least, of producing and creating new opera. Speaking just from my vantage point, I'm doing 4 world premieres this year, 3 in Dallas and 1 in Santa Fe, like big companies putting on and taking the risk and creating new opera. And I think that's sort of a new – it's getting momentum. And I wonder if Gantry wasn't sort of on the forefront of that.
It was the thing maybe that pushed everybody else to say, maybe we can do this.
Yeah, we can do this. Mm-hmm. And you wonder if not. And part of – you know, it's – I think it's fascinating because one of the great things about Gantry is the Americanism, is the sort of the accessibility of it. But it's also extremely sophisticated music. Mm-hmm. And so this sort of ability to tie together accessible tunes that just grab you immediately – and have it sophisticated, and it's based on a novel that is on the public consciousness, right? Like you hear Elmer Gantry. I had never read the book, and I had never seen the movie. But you hear Elmer Gantry go, "Oh yeah, yeah, I know Elmer Gantry," and you're like, "Who wrote that?" Oh, Sinclair Lewis. That's neat. But even that sort of takes away some of the inherent.
Is so new, I can't do it.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So for an audience, it's more accessible because, Elmer Gantry, I know what that is. Or I could.
Or maybe I do, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, well, like Little Women and Moby Dick.
Sure.
That's like Moby Dick.
Yeah.
That's
Everest.
Right. Uh-huh. Everest is Into Thin Air. I'm doing Cold Mountain this summer. There's an immediate sort of, you know what? I want to give this a shot. It's something new. It's something exciting. And there's a reference point I can tie into beyond the fact that why are they just singing? Why don't they talk?
I was going to say, I think what I'm noticing is that there are lots of books and movies that are being, you know, chosen because it's something that's familiar, that's going to be appealing to an audience. Manchurian Candidate is opening tonight. Dead Man Walking is another one, you know, and JFK is something that's being written and workshopped right now. I think that kind of general appeal is something that will bring people in. I have friends who aren't in the business but who do want to come because they don't want to see the same old thing. They want to see something different and new. And I think that just because people choose to write a libretto or to write music to these very familiar stories doesn't mean that that language is going to be what you expect. The musical language is going to be what you expect. Neither does it mean that the story that you've read is going to be the same thing you see on the stage. You know, they have to create a libretto from that book or from the movie.
Absolutely.
So there's a lot of adjusting that happens, and I think that, you know, it's an adventure. It's an adventure that the audience comes on with us.
Well, what is exciting to me is that it seems like that adventure, people are embracing it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that, as you say, it's a risk, but producers and general managers and singers and conductors, everybody is kind of out there going, you know, this is a risk worth taking.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That this isn't a museum art form.
That's right. And it's not – the idea of basing an opera on found literature is hardly new. Like, you know, you have – I guess, you know, all the Beaumarchais trilogy is the basis of Figaro and Nozze and all that. And there's a real art to it too. Like, so one of the great things I think about this piece is the way Herschel – was able to sort of find a keyhole into the story and distill the story. I mean, Gantry is a very long novel.
Yeah.
Lewis was not a
short
story writer. No.
Brevity was not his thing. And to be able to sort of find that keyhole in and be able to tell the story in a distilled version, especially when most of it's sung, which everything gets elongated anyway, there's a real art to that. And that's, I think, part of the genius of this work is someone who could, like Katie was saying, it's a different language. It's not unlike Shakespeare – into opera is a difficult difficult jump, and it takes a librettist like Boito or the Britten Pair sort of turning it on its head in Midsummer Night's Dream, and so to make it sort of relatable in an operatic sort of milieu where it's you can have a soundscape. Anyway, I think I'm kind of babbling.
No,
I'm really good.
No,
is this
not.
Is this on?
Basically, it's its own art form. It's somebody has to have the skill to be able to do that. Just
Absolutely.
Because you can write the book doesn't mean you can write the libretto.
Absolutely. Right. You know? They're very different.
You have to know how to edit too. I mean, there are some things that we love so much about these stories that we you know want to hear and we expect to hear as we come into the opera, and they've been edited out because they just they add on something that has nothing to do with the core of what we're trying to say in the story. In the
right.
Opera.
Yeah. Risking the wrath of the book lovers.
Yes.
Wait,
yeah,
that was my favorite scene.
Right.
You took that out. Yeah.
Katie and I actually had the opportunity to do Little Women several years ago, and that's a classic example of a book that's, you know, 3 inches thick, that Mark Adamo himself, he wrote his own libretto and condensed it down to very universal human themes, and did leave out some. There's a whole piano scene that he left out from the book that I miss. But at the same time, it's very powerful because he chose themes that everyone could relate to. You know, letting go of the past in a way, and letting go of certain things to move on in life. But the relationship between librettist and composer is so important, and I think. I know that Bob and Herschel work so closely together on this. They really sit down and work together a lot of the time as Bob is composing. It makes such a huge difference. And I know Jake Hague is the same way, Gene Shear and Jake Hague.
Absolutely.
That that relationship between a composer and a trusted librettist is just so important.
What I want to do right now is thank you, all three of you, for coming in and talking about this and about your passion, about new work and about this work in particular. Break a Leg, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Mezzo-soprano Catherine Procht sings the role of Sharon Falconer. Bass Kevin Burdett is T.J. Rigg. And Christopher Larkin conducts the Florentine Opera's production of Elmer Gantry. It runs this Friday and Sunday at the Marcus Center. There is more information from a link at WUWM.com.
Another break now, and in just a few minutes, a Wisconsin native singer-songwriter John Stotts previews some songs from his brand new album. Keep listening. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.